A new study indicates that adults who are at risk of type 2 diabetes, if they cannot wear the trousers, the jeans, whatever you want to call them, that they donned at the sprightly young age of 21. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by Professor Roy Taylor. He's director of the Newcastle Magnetic Resonance Centre and professor of medicine and metabolism at the University of Newcastle. He's also an honorary consultant physician at Newcastle Acute Hospital NHS Trust. Roy, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be here.
We're delighted to have you because I know the headline itself, it's covered in quite a wide range of publications, but even the headline has prompted an awful lot of commentary. What is the thinking behind requiring, not you specifically, but the body, requiring a waist size that we all of us may wish to have sprouted at 21 in order to mitigate against our risk of developing type 2 diabetes?
Yes, very good question. I should first say that I'm a doctor looking after real people. And one of the problems I face on behalf of my patients is that 1 in 10 people developing type 2 diabetes have got a normal body mass index. Now, that's a calculation, and in numbers, it's less than 25. It's just a measure of how heavy someone is.
Mm.
But if they're in that range, they look quite slim. And that is quite notable because why have they got type 2 diabetes? Well, it's something that we have to sort out. And over the past 10 years, we've been working out exactly what causes type 2 diabetes. And we can say quite clearly that it's a condition of having too much fat inside the liver and inside the pancreas, but only a small amount of fat. But very clearly, it's nothing to do with obesity or any concept of being above a certain weight. It's a matter of an individual being too heavy for themselves. Now,
that's a really great way to put it, actually, too heavy for yourself, because I think that that kind of language will have currency with most people rather than something like a BMI or a weight on a scales.
Well, that's right. We're all individuals, Kiara, and that's really important. And this is somewhat lost off when the headlines talk about obesity. Now, obesity is defined as a BMI over 30. Now, by that measure, the Irish rugby team would all be in serious trouble. And of course, they're not. The point is, we're individuals, and people come in all sorts of frame sizes. You only have to look at people walking down the street. But it's all very well having ideas in medicine. We've got to go out and try and destroy those ideas. And if we can't destroy them, that might be right. So what we did was to take a whole group of these people with type 2 diabetes, but looking slim, and we measured what was going on inside them. But even more, we got them to lose weight. Now, almost all of them have been told that they mustn't lose weight by their doctor because they already have normal BMI. But we got them to lose weight, and hey presto, their diabetes went away. And we were able to measure what was going inside, and it's just a tiny shift in the amount of fat inside the liver and inside the pancreas. So if anyone listening to this has got a strong family history of diabetes, the writing's on the wall. You really need to get down to the waist size you were when you were 21, because that's a better measure than just stepping on the scales and worrying about obesity or these population-based measures.
But actually, Mary has tweeted us what I think is a really fair question. And she wants to know if that waist size when you were 21 applies equally to men and women and those who have been through pregnancy. Because she says even after having a baby, a woman may achieve the same weight, but not the same body shape. So it's not body shape that is the key here.
Yes, this is a really good point. But let me be quite clear. And I have to say, I'm speaking with some experience here because I used to look after the medical obstetric clinic in Newcastle. And so this is something I've tackled quite a lot. During pregnancy, the hip size increases disproportionately. And it's very difficult to get that back down to the snake hips of adolescence. The waist size does not. And I used to advise all my patients to do a Victoria Beckham. In other words, yes, you need to work hard to get your weight down after pregnancy. you will get your waist size back, but you won't get your hip size back. So it's an absolutely fair point. But I'm talking about the waist size, and that's a measure of the fat inside the tummy. And that's the relatively dangerous depot of fat, because it's a reflection of how much is actually inside the organs where it can be doing the damage.
And that is a really key point, I suppose, in the wider social and societal understanding of diabetes. It's fat around the internal organs, specifically the liver and pancreas, that we must be most concerned about in the context of overall health and well-being.
That's correct. And this touches on a really important human point, Chiara, because most of my patients in this category have been told by some health professional, you mustn't lose weight. But they're told by their friends, well, diabetes is due to bad diet and overeating. And they're labelled as having something to do with obesity. But this is nothing to do with obesity. It's just the luck of the draw with the genes that you get. You're planned, you're pre-programmed to put a bit more fat inside the organs where it will cause damage. And so the only way you can avoid this is to get into those genes you used to wear, or taking the point before, perhaps not those genes, it's the waist measurement that's the thing. And I can give you some numbers, because the ladies in our study used to have a waist measurement of 30 inches, and they had crept up to the dizzy heights of 34. Now, bear in mind, this is a slice of people who are in this slim category we're talking about. Women shouldn't say, but that's terrible, I'm way above that. They are them, and this is in no way criticism of them. But our ladies in the study came down from 34 to 30 and got rid of their diabetes. So there's a big message here, and yes, it does have a societal impact as well.
And Jimmy has given us a call. He was diagnosed 23 years ago, and in his experience, the medication that may generally be prescribed here for people with type 2 diabetes, and I don't expect you, Roy, to be intimately familiar with that, but can cause people to increase weight. So he's kind of struggling to see how those in your study were able to go into remission. Was that because of the base weight that they started at the beginning of the study? They were in what most people might call a slimmer category.
Two things there. First of all, your listener is absolutely correct. Some of the drugs, especially the drugs that have got names like glitazide or tolbutamide, an even older drug, do actually put on the weight, and that's troublesome. But we actually stop all the drugs at the start of the study on day one of the diet, and the fasting level of sugar falls with this low-calorie diet. So we can get away from this problem of the drugs. But I have to say in the same breath that if someone has had type 2 diabetes for over 20 years, then the chances of them getting rid of it completely are relatively less. So I think that is a really important point.
And I think you've given us all certainly food for thought, no pun intended. Professor Roy Taylor, Director of Newcastle Magnetic Resonance Centre, Professor of Medicine and Metabolism at the University of Newcastle, and Honorary Consultant Physician at Newcastle Acute Hospital NHS Trust, even. Thank you indeed for joining us. Jay, with tongue very firmly in cheek, has WhatsApped us 0833 97 97 97, saying his flares still fit him, but only around the ankles. On now to matters a little different. I'm joined on the line by Dr. Ina Kelly. She's president of the Irish Medical Organisation. Ina, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you, Ciara.
Your organisation has revealed its pre-budget submission, and I think that the capacity for in the acute bed sector of the health service is something that we've all become certainly passingly familiar with since the beginning of the pandemic. It's been very much a topic of discussion. You say the critical care bed needs to be doubled at least.
Yes, there was a bed capacity review some years ago, And it did identify that we are very behind in the number of beds we need. But we know that we need about 5,000 additional public acute beds because of the demography of the country as well. I mean, we're getting a lot, a rising population, plus a rising population of people who are older, who will have chronic diseases and so on, will need a little bit more hospitalisation. But also, I suppose, we know for decades now that our critical care beds are inadequate, the numbers we have. And we feel that the number really needs to be about twice this in order to be closer to what would be the international norm, you know, in developed countries. So it's something that is really important because, as we can see in Ireland, because we had such little capacity, we really needed to be extra stringent in relation to our control of COVID because we knew we were going to get people into intensive care and we didn't want to have to obviously ration it, you know, not be able to look after people who really, really needed it, you know. So it was, it's something that our lack of capacity there puts a terrible burden on the rest of the health service, you know. And when you know that when your ICU beds are filling up, you have to cancel elective surgeries and so on as well because, you know, you need to have an ICU bed available after surgery for people who might need it. They might only need it for a day or so, but still you need to have it available. And so having inadequate capacity backs up all the other services that are required in the hospital too. So having, you know, enough ICU beds is just a critical part of having a well-functioning health service. And, you know, the rest of the beds are also required. I mean, we know that the population in Ireland is increasing quite significantly, you know, and we're over 5 million now and so on, that it's important that we have the beds that we need for the population we have.
I think the difficulty, with addressing this problem is that it has been within the health service, you know, all through its various name changes and various reorganisations for so long that it almost seems to be a cultural part of it, that there is a shortage of critical care beds. We know that there are difficulties recruiting staff to care for those in those care beds. So this is quite a complex problem to address.
It is. No, I'm not saying it's an easy problem, and it isn't a cheap problem either, insofar as, you know, providing healthcare is expensive and it requires long timelines in order to train people. You need to make those jobs attractive so people will come and they'll stay. You know, what you don't want is a lot of turnover and people training and then going somewhere else because they're so well trained that they have an awful lot of attractive jobs elsewhere to go to. So in Ireland, really, we just haven't prioritised health to the same extent that I think our population would like us to, because we can see that in the last year and a half or 20 months or so, that people really do prioritise health. People sacrifice so much for not just their own health, but their health of their families and their community. And, you know, I think it's sort of indicative of the fact that people really do care about health. You know, we all know health is better than wealth or whatever, or health is your wealth, or those sorts of phrases that we've often used, but they're not real cliches. They're actually true. And I think it's something that you can't really have a successful society without the healthcare that is a reasonable expectation of that society. And, you know, and our population, you know, wish for a certain level of healthcare, and we just never seem to provide it in Ireland. Now, it isn't easy to provide it insofar as you have to invest. And I think that we're going to, you know, we really need to invest properly. You know, we've invested now and again. We often hear, we put a lot of money into it in the last year or two or whatever, but it needs to be every year and it needs to be enough every year.
And I think
it needs to match what we need.
Investing properly is a key point because you could conceivably just throw money at the problem. It'll go into a black hole or it'll be absorbed by administrative matters. It won't go where it needs to go. So is the information available to those who are allocating budgets to suggest to them precisely where the money should go, or is greater assessment needed of that?
Well, it's always going to be an ongoing situation that you need to continue. You need to continuously assess as well, because the technology changes within healthcare as well. I mean, at different times, you find the way you manage problems change. You know, the more you put into, say, primary care, the less you're going to need the burden on secondary care. Like, say, so the more general practitioners and other healthcare providers in the primary care area are actually resourced, the less the hospital, the burden on hospitals. So it sort of depends. You have to look at the whole picture and you need to make sure you need to line up all of the I suppose the needs that people have, and make sure you're solving it at the place where you're going to get the best effectiveness and efficiency and quality and so on. And like, we do know a lot of these things, but I'm not sure that everything has got an integrated plan associated with it. And we don't really do multi-annual budgeting in Ireland as well. So we're always at a disadvantage there, that we're not really looking at the whole picture at any time. Now, I know Sláinte Care was sort of designed to look at that, but, you know, it's an ongoing, things change all the time as well. Mm. So you need to be keeping up your analysis of what's going on, because you may find that what we thought was essential a few years ago may be superseded by something else as well. And, you know, and as pressures come somewhere else, solving it in one place won't solve it somewhere else as well. So you need to look at the whole picture before you're, you know, as you're going along, because you need to keep implementing it too, yeah.
Well, Dr. Aine Kelly, President of the Irish Medical Organisation, thank you indeed for joining us. We all remember that article in the Irish Mail on Sunday, which I suppose it was a critique, if you want to use that a very polite word, of the appearance of many Fianna Fáil politicians, the overwhelming majority of them women. And indeed, we covered that article and its implications here on Kildare Focus with Fiona O'Loughlin and Women for Elections, Katrina Gleeson. That has prompted, I suppose, a refocusing and a re-examination of how women and girls in society are viewed and the effect upon them of trying to live up to unattainable standards of beauty. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by Dr. Rachel Woodlock. She's Assistant Lecturer in the Study of Religions at the University College Cork. Rachel, you're very welcome to the programme.
Hi, Kira. Thanks for having me.
Delighted to do so. It seems in an awful lot of ways, regardless of the standard of beauty that may be in vogue at the time in question, that women and girls are damned if they do adhere to that standard and damned if they don't.
Oh, absolutely. And you're right in saying that it does wax and wane, and different beauty standards are applied differently in different cultures. But it always seems to be a common universal link that one of the ways that we in cultures and societies judge women's worth is based on how they attain or don't attain whatever the current fashion beauty trend is. And the placing of worth on that is where it's really problematic.
And placing of worth has historically not applied to men really at all, except for certain and limited circumstances. Arguably, certainly in the social media context, it is beginning to be applied to them, and perhaps more of that anon. But the weight that, of expectation, consciously or otherwise, that it places on women and girls, unless you've experienced it yourself, it may be really difficult to understand.
Yes, I mean, we tend to put different focuses or measures of worth on men, but it's particularly women's bodies where we experience the most pressure. And the sexual attraction of bodies is where we get a lot of focus. And it is true that men are starting to increasingly be objectified sexually. We see this in the rise of eating disorders, even in young men now, and the type of hyper-sexualized bodies that we see on shows like Love Island, where women, men with very masculinized, the six-pack, the oily kind of bare chests and so on. But we also know from the way that studies have looked at how our brains process images of men and women, there are differences in how our brains process sexually objectified bodies, and there tends to be more of a focus on denigrating women when they're presented as sexual objects than men. So we tend to, our brains are trained to identify sexualized women as being less than human or more like animals or more like objects. So we actually are coding our brains to dehumanize women when we view them as sex objects.
There's also a very interesting flip side to that, and it's when women, particularly in the public eye, elect not to present themselves as sexualized objects and remove that particular facet that they could elect to include in their public persona completely from it. I'm thinking specifically of Angela Merkel and Hillary Clinton. And
yes.
Both Hillary Clinton went for a period of time without wearing makeup to make a political statement. And the reaction to that was particularly interesting. And I know that you've written about Angela Merkel, who regularly, and I'm quoting you directly here, took hits for being too frumpy in her signature black-coloured blazers, yet too provocative for displaying a hint of cleavage during a visit to the opera in 2008. So, there's no way to navigate those waters and satisfy all sides of public opinion. So the question is, should we bother?
Well, yeah, exactly. And part of the reason why is because the machine of selling women's bodies is so powerful because it is so alluring. We use women's bodies to sell everything from perfume to cars to guns to everything is used. You know, women's bodies are used to sell so much. So consequently, if you try and reject that machinery, then you're actually become the target of scorn and the target of still focus and attention on how you present yourself. So it becomes very, very difficult to fight against it. And this is, I think, something that the politicians in the Irish media, in this case, the Fianna Fáil politicians experience, but they're certainly not the only ones, in that there seems to be no way to win. There's no way to succeed. But certainly resisting that very hyper-sexualized narrative, I think, is really important, particularly for our young girls. Mm. We're finding more and more that even preteen girls are being targeted with this very hyper-sexualized clothing. Now, it's really important also to not to victim blame. So one of the things that the science has shown also too is that one of the ways that we dehumanize women is we blame them for the types of clothes that they're wearing. We see this with rape trials, for example, and this is something that's come up with the recent Women of Honour issue with armed forces, because, you know, women being asked, well, what were you wearing when you were raped, is how we also dehumanize and victim blame women. So it's really important not to go down that route. What I'm criticizing is the narrative that we choose to engage in through journalism, through media, through the types of media that we consume, through, you know, what we
and
say.
And also our own private conversations, because media only has so much influence.
Sure.
And that influence, I'm not saying it's not without power, it is very powerful. But even were you and I, Rachel, to be sitting having a cup of coffee or a glass of wine or whatever it is you're having yourself, and then discussing some woman we saw down the road and what she was dressing, we're drawing assumptions about her. We're making those assumptions based on what she is wearing. And each of us have to take responsibility for the actions that we choose on the basis of those assumptions.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the key differences between how men and women sexualize women is that men tend to do it in terms of sexual attractiveness. So they will objectify women's bodies on the basis of sexual attraction, whereas women tend to do it on the basis of wanting to reject a similarity. So they will say, we're not like those ones that appear on Love Island. We don't want to be associated with that, precisely because of the link between that and the dehumanisation and even the risk of sexual violence. So we do it ourselves. It's really important to remember and take a step back and say, when I'm criticising anyone for having put on a bit of weight and wearing clothes that don't suit her, whether it's my neighbour or if it's, you know, the Polly on the telly, that I'm engaging in that process too.
And it's interesting that women seem to make a moral adjudication, whereas men make a sexualised adjudication.
Absolutely. We tend to get very catty and very bitchy, and this is where we get this strange kind of obsession with, you know, I mentioned in my article about there's this unwritten rule that you can show, you know, a bit of cleavage up top, so long as you've got your legs covered, for fear of being perceived as, and we use pejorative terms like slutty or, you know, asking for it or whatever, that this is, again, this process of dehumanising women and their bodies and how we view them.
Well, Dr. Rachel Woodlock, Assistant Lecturer in the Study of Religions, University College Cork, thank you so much for joining us. Now, new data released by the Department of Housing showing that there's been a very slight reduction in the number of people who are homeless in Kildare, but right across the country there seems to be an increase in the number of families and children living in emergency accommodation. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by Aisling Harmy. She's Marketing and Communications Manager at Simon Community. Aisling, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks for having me on, Ciara.
Delighted to do so. What is, I suppose, your headline takeaway from August's figures?
So I suppose the number of adults in emergency accommodation in Kildare is reducing. It's 120 in August. Last month in July, it was 125. And last year in August, it was 144. So that is a slight glimmer of hope that things are getting a little bit better. The Department of Housing, Local Government and Heritage doesn't give us a breakdown by county for family homelessness, but in the Mid-East, which covers Kildare, Wicklow and Meath, there are 46 families, which is 72 adults and 92 children in emergency accommodation. Overall, nationally, the figures are going up. There's an increase of 80 people from July. Single homeless adults is slightly down nationally as well. But there is an increase in homeless families. Nationally, it's 953, which is about 23 more than it was in July. So these are all lives interrupted here that we're talking about. These adults and families, they're trying to live their lives in a state of total uncertainty, not knowing what the future holds. And if you can imagine, in August, these families are people that are trying to get their children back into school. The evenings are drawing in and they don't know where they're going to be this Christmas time. So it's really bleak for people who find themselves in this situation.
And I also think, Aisling, it might be fair to point out that at this juncture, these are the department's statistics, but these are just the people that the department is aware of. There are thousands of people couch surfing, you know, staying in somebody's box room for a couple of weeks who are homeless but just aren't included in this bulletin.
So that's it, exactly. The housing report issued by the Department of Housing is actually doesn't include people that are sleeping rough or in direct provision or in women's shelters or those people known as hidden homeless who are staying with families or friends. It only literally includes people who are actually actively registered in emergency accommodation. And really, whether the figures are going up and down is it's a good barometer of the current level of need, but it doesn't give us anything like the true picture of the number of people that are in a kind of a housing or homelessness crisis.
And what makes this so bleak is because we could all of us, you know, read all of the reports, listen to the news bulletins, read all of the publications, and virtually every day we hear something more about the housing crisis. We had three reports yesterday, house prices going up. That's a pipe dream for an awful lot of people, which means more and more people are in unstable rental accommodation if they can find rental accommodation at all. So this situation is nowhere near close to resolution.
No, the really one of the really sad statistics that we've seen is more than half of Dublin Simon's clients, those in emergency accommodation or supported housing, have spent 3 or more years in homelessness. And 42% of those have spent more than 5 years living in that limbo of emergency accommodation. So 3 years is a very long time. That's how long it takes somebody to get a degree. Mm. 5 years must feel like forever. And if you couple that with a global pandemic, then it's fair to say that this population is living literally through the worst crisis imaginable. These are people who are desperate to exit homelessness, and yet they're spending longer than ever without a home of their own. And in our experience, the kind of physical, emotional and mental toll of those long spells in homelessness leads to a really big increase in demand for healthcare supports and addiction issues and the need for addiction treatment. So, for instance, at Dublin Simon last year, we saw a 23% increase in demand for addiction treatment in our healthcare services, things like our counselling supports or our crisis out of hours suicide line, also increases in demand because people are spending so much longer in this position and really feel like there's no light at the end of the tunnel for them.
And I suppose we should point out at this juncture, Aisling, that Dublin Simon, whilst it is called Dublin Simon, does provide significant services in Kildare and in Meath.
That's right. So Dublin Simon actually covers Dublin, Kildare, Wicklow, Meath, Louth, Cavan and Monaghan. So although it's known as Dublin Simon, we're delivering services across a range of counties. If any of your listeners are in living in Kildare and in Meath, please reach out to us. You can email us at kildare@dubsimon.ie or visit our website at dubsimon.ie to get in our contact details.
Well, Aisling Harmy, Marketing and Communications Manager at Dublin Simon, thank you indeed for joining us. New data released under the Freedom of Information Act showed there were 121 children under the age of 16 hospitalised for treatment for anorexia last year. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line now by Harriet Parsons, Training and Development Manager at Bodywise. Harriet, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks, Ciara.
That's a very concerning number of very young children.
It is, yeah. I suppose when we look at the rise in numbers of people attending services and using our support services since March 2020 in the lockdown, it's kind of expected. Like, I'm not that surprised by it. There has been a huge increase in people developing eating disorders since the pandemic.
And do you have a sense as to why that might be?
I think that there's lots of reasons. Like, the obvious ones are, you know, that it was a pandemic, that it was, you know, a time of uncertainty, and it was traumatic, you know, in different ways for different people, if people were ill or passed away. But then in more kind of subtle ways, I think, you know, with eating disorders, the average age of onset is kind of 13 to 18, so it's that kind of teenage years. And for that group of people, you know, their peers are really important for them. For them, their peers kind of help to ground their sense of self, you know, who I am, who I am in the world, what I mean, all of that, more than family. And so when lockdown came, you know, they were taken out of school, they were at home, they weren't mixing with friends. And I suppose what I've heard in the past year, you know, from our family support program and talking to parents and supporting parents, is that for those young people who maybe were vulnerable in their personality, so they may have been quite all or nothing in their thinking, a tendency towards being anxious and worrying, quite high achievers, perfectionists, that some of those young people then coped with the pandemic and the change in circumstance and the uncertainty by creating certainty in their own life. And that certainty is created through managing, or we could say controlling, what I'm eating, how I'm exercising, and my physical self. And you could see it in another form across, you know, across the country. You know, everyone was baking banana bread and, you know, running marathons in their back garden, and, you know, in within my 2K, you know, how can I, you know, do as much exercise? And we had, you know, all the YouTube exercise things people were doing. And so, you know, everybody was struggling with this new normal. And I think so. I think all of that kind of culminated in young people just having a really hard time. We see with younger kids a lot of anxiety as well. And that's all coming from, you know, not having their peer group around them, their routine around them, the normal kind of balancing, regulating structures of school, routine, activities, you know.
And so in so many ways, they were left almost literally at sea. But the important thing, I suppose, that we should point out about anorexia is that even according to the HSE, it has the highest death rate of all mental health disorders. It can be fatal for those who live with the condition.
Yeah, so that's quite a scary idea. It's quite scary to know that anorexia would have the highest mortality rate of all psychiatric illnesses. One of the reasons for that is that people become so physically unwell. And so what you're seeing in those hospital figures that you mentioned at the beginning, they're the people who have become so physically at risk of something catastrophic happening that they needed to be taken into a hospital, a general hospital, to be made well, made safe. So that would mean kind of managing them, feeding them, making them physically well. But that's only kind of taking care of one bit of the problem of the eating disorder, because eating disorders are very complicated. They are about how a person feels about themselves and emotional distress that manifests in this controlling food and body. So, you know, the treatment is never going to be just one thing. But that is the scary thing about anorexia, is that people can go downhill very quickly, and people are really at risk when they're physically so malnourished.
The figures also kind of suggest, whilst it has been predominantly and the vast majority of people who seek treatment for anorexia are women and girls, and that remains the case, it does seem that the proportion of boys who are seeking treatment for the condition has increased.
Yeah, so that's something that is replicated, you know, across all services, that, you know, the majority of people with an eating disorder are female, but there's a growing number of males being affected. In fact, I think Temple Street came out with figures in the summer, the beginning of the summer, saying that there had been a 66% rise in hospital admissions for them, but 40% of those admissions were male. So, you know, eating disorders affect boys, they affect men. I hear it on the family support program. There are parents of boys and men. Now, you know, it's taken that about 25% of cases are male. Officially, it's one in every 10, but we think that that's an underrepresentation because it's not recognized in men so often, and it's often perceived as a female illness. But also, I think the reason why you might not see that in those particular hospital figures as well is that maybe for boys it manifests slightly differently, and they haven't gotten so as low weight or at much physical risk as the girls did.
Well, Harriet,
maybe it manifests differently.
Well, Harriet Parsons, unfortunately, time is against us, but a training and development manager at Bodywise, thank you indeed for joining us.